Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I'm okay. I managed to survive the anniversary, which was last week, of my dad's death that we talk about a lot on the show, and it happened and I was okay. Yeah, it was okay this year. It wasn't so intense as last year, which was nice, but yeah, you know how it is, right guys? Never like the favourite moment of the year. I'm also been watching Game of Thrones, so that's definitely cheered things up. Game of Thrones back. Oh, so tense. Don't worry, no spoilers here. Thank you so much for your wonderful, wonderful responses to last week's episode with Felix White. I know it was a really intense and emotional episode. If you haven't listened to that already, I definitely recommend it. It's, yeah, definitely up there. I don't like saying favourites because I feel bad because, you know, all these people have died. I don't want to choose one. But I really enjoyed talking to Felix. It was really, really wonderful. And he was so open and emotional about a lot of stuff, and yeah, it's a really special episode, so check that out. We have a live episode coming up on June the 6th at the Udderbelly Festival. I will be talking all things grief and death and funerals with Jeff Lloyd from the Adrift podcast and Reason to Be Cheerful, and Camille Youcan from Birthday Girls, which recently just got nominated for the British Podcast Awards Best Comedy. And I will also be talking to Josie Long as well, who's joined the panel. Very exciting. So yeah, head to the Udderbelly Festival or the Griefcast Twitter to find out more information. This week I'm talking to Canadian writer Taya Lim. Taya is the author of An Ocean of Minutes, which is out in paperback now. It was nominated for the Scotiabank Giller Prize, which is, as you'll hear, a very big deal in Canada. It's her debut novel, and yeah, it is a really beautiful novel. It's not, as you'll hear, it's not about grief, perhaps in the sense that other writers I've talked to about, like, a very personal story. It's definitely a novel version of that, but it definitely touches on a lot of the stuff we talk about loss and pain and emotion and grief, basically. Yeah, she's a really interesting woman, and it's a fascinating read. I definitely recommend it. Taya came in to talk to me about all sorts of different forms of grief, but especially her father-in-law, Eugene. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with writer Taya Lim, who is the author of An Ocean of Minutes, which recently won
got shortlisted for. What did it? What's the name of the award?
It's the Scotiabank Giller Prize.
So Scotia, the, say that again,
Taya. Scotiabank Giller Prize.
Scotia, and that's equivalent. You said like the Man Booker, but in the
Man Booker was only Canadian.
Only Canadian. Yeah. That's a fancy name.
It is fancy.
Scotiabank Giller.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. Actually, has some connection, I think, to Griefcast, because the prize was started by a fellow named Jack Rabinovich in the mid 90s, and the reason why it's called the Giller Prize is because he named it for his late wife, who really loved books and literature. So
that is nice.
That's
perfect.
Quite beautiful. Yeah,
that's very perfect. Mm-hmm. Ocean of Minutes. So it came out quite recently. Is that right?
In June in the UK.
Mm-hmm. It's an amazing book. I was very fortunate to be. Well, actually, my husband got sent a copy, and I borrowed his copy. But it's absolutely brilliant. When did you finish it? Because I know the publishing.
Right, it takes a long time. Yeah. So I started. I didn't write it with a contract or an editor, or agent, or anything like that. I sort of trucked along on my own, and then it would have been late 2015 that I started submitting it to agents and found one just 2 or 3 weeks before my daughter was born in 2016.
Wow.
Yeah, and then that slowed me down slightly, just a wee bit.
Yeah.
So we wound up sending it out to publishers in early 2017, and then it came out in June 2018.
Wow.
I know, it's a long journey for a book. It's not like other forms.
Yeah, people don't realize it is. Mm-hmm. Books and films move very slowly. That's why I like comedy, because you can just write it and perform it that night.
Ooh.
And be like, "What, did that work?
I should become a comedian."
Well, I don't know. There's other negatives, but the process is very fast and satisfying in that way, whereas I know books and films take so long.
Yes, yeah.
And so the book is kind of, it's sort of set in this world, but not, I think that's fair to
say. Kind of an alternate world.
Yeah, but definitely things that we all recognise. The world is our world. But there's been a pandemic.
Yes.
And, well, you're probably going to explain about it again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sort of relating to what you just said, I was interested in writing true science fiction. So I was sort of curious about what would it really be like to time travel? You know, we tend to think of time travel as this sort of adventurous thing, but I thought, what would really be the things that would come along with it? But essentially, in the book, so it's 1981, and Polly decides to take a job elsewhere to get medical care for her lover, Frank, who's deathly ill because there has been a pandemic, as you said. But the thing that's a little bit different is that she's not going to take a job in another place. She's taking a job in another time. It's 12 years in the future. And when she actually gets to the other side, she's even later than she thought she was going to be. It's been 17 years, and she can't find Frank. So the novel is about her trying to find Frank, but also it's about her determination to kind of recuperate this moment from her past, which to her doesn't feel like the past because it was just yesterday, but it's actually been 17 years. So she's trying to kind of make this thing that was in the past happen again, return to a moment, sort of bring it to life again. And she also comes across many other people who are doing the same thing in different ways. So it's sort of, the novel is peopled by all these characters who are struggling to come to terms with something that they've lost, that they just cannot accept that it's no longer a part of their present.
So obviously when reading it, I was like, oh, this fits my brief. Because it's, Polly is a character who can't let go. And I found that really interesting because in the book, you know, to her it seems like yesterday. And everyone else is kind of like, it was 17 years ago.
Right, right.
Which I really related to is, so it's been 20 years since my dad died.
Yeah.
And I think traumatic things, if you haven't been through them, people often forget, like it burns in your memory. And it does seem like yesterday.
Yeah.
So I thought Polly, it was a very interesting character from the point of bereavement and grief, that to her everything's so fresh and so raw, and everyone else is like, it's a really long time ago.
I know, exactly. And that was really why I was interested in the time jump, because it was a way to sort of animate an experience that tends to be more internal, right? And that exists in our world. But I was interested in how could I make it kind of into a plot, into a story, to really understand, I think, the paces of that kind of heartbreak. Because it's true, it never leaves you.
You know?
And I think even if Polly had lost someone and then 17 years later, she would still feel that loss, I think, as intensely as when she jumps over those 17 years. And that's why I think there's also those other characters who have lost someone in the real world in a bit longer period of time, but they also kind of can't let go. And I was really interested in offering different portraits of how people try to let go and sort of showing that everyone is kind of terrible at it, I think, in different ways.
Yeah, so we were talking before about your own experiences of grief, but what has been the biggest experience of grief that you've gone through?
Right. I can't say that this was the biggest, but it was the most intimate. So in 2007, I met somebody. I started dating this person, Ryan, and we were living in Toronto, and he was actually there temporarily, and I said, why are you here? And he said, well, my dad is sick, so I've come to help out. And I think at the time I thought, that was very sweet. And
all these everything's sweet in the beginning. Oh, he does that. Yeah. How nice.
Well, it still was, but I think what became clear, we were together for, you know, after a few weeks, it wasn't a very long period of time, was that his dad was not only sick, but he was dying.
Right.
And I think we'd known each other 2 or 3 months and had this sort of whirlwind courtship when his father actually went into palliative care. So I had actually, you know, like many people, I think by the time you reach your late 20s or your 30s, you've probably known, actually, unfortunately, a lot of people who either, you know, have left your life or have passed away. So, you know, I'd had grandparents who'd passed away. I had an uncle who died, and a friend actually earlier that year had died in a hostel fire. But something about witnessing, I think, the steps of someone dying and sort of doing the labor, I think, of death and watching this family go through it, it sort of stayed with me in this strange way. And
so what was your Ryan's dad's name?
Eugene.
And did he have cancer?
He had liver cancer, which is a very bad one to get. Like the survival rate for liver cancer is very low. And it's very sudden, you know, so he sort of found out that he had it, and within the year he was gone.
Wow.
But I think he very much believed in the power of positive thinking. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't want his family to talk about the fact that he was dying or to talk about it in that way. And he was very sort of convinced that he was going to beat it. And they tried all these kind of alternative treatments. Like they went to, I think, this ranch in Tijuana, and they did all these different things.
Wow.
So when finally the doctor said, well, you know, it's time for you to move into palliative care, it was very shocking because that wasn't the conversations they'd been having. It wasn't what they'd been preparing themselves
for. So you think Eugene had kind of, you know, held in his head somehow some magic thing is going to happen.
It was going to work, yeah. I mean, and he would say, I remember I went over to their house one evening and he was too sick to come down to the table, so he was upstairs and they had rigged up, this was before cell phones, so I can't remember, well, not that much before cell phones, but they had rigged up some way of him being over an intercom or something.
Right,
I can't remember, it was very cute. And he was saying, you know, next time you all come over, I'll be better and I'm going to cook for you, you know, and that was really his attitude. And so when he went into palliative care, I remember it just being, and again, this was someone that I didn't know very well, but the sense of how irreversible it was just like I couldn't quite grasp it. It seemed so awful that it could be so irreversible in such a way that he was never going to come out of palliative care.
So by palliative care, do you mean a hospice?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So it was a floor in a hospital,
right,
quite a famous cancer hospital. It was the floor where you go to die, essentially.
Right.
So like I said, it was a strange thing because he wasn't someone I knew well, and I would say that I met him 3 times.
Wow.
Yeah, the first 2 times it was sort of in the house and maybe from a bit of a distance, because also I was a new girlfriend. And the third time was actually when he was in palliative care, and I went in to his hospital room because Ryan said, oh, my dad, you know, he wants to have a chat with you, because I think they knew sort of at that point that he was going, and obviously this wasn't the situation under which he wanted to meet me, but it was our only chance. And, you know, he didn't look anything like his pictures or anything like that. He was very sick by that point. And, you know, I went into the room and he held my hand and he said, Taya, be brave. And
wow.
Something that sort of haunted me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know, because it was funny. It was sort of like we didn't have, it was a very intimate thing. And
you
I
didn't
sort
have
of,
time for this. So how are you?
Right. Yeah.
Where are and your parents
yes,
from?
I know. Yeah. And he couldn't really speak. You know, and I sort of often thought to myself, it's very strange. I feel like I was maybe the last person he met, you know, which is an odd kind of thing. And I think it haunted me because I wondered, like, why did he say that? You know, what did he see in me? What did it mean? You know,
and
I don't think, now I look back, at the time that was how I felt. Now I look back and I think that we were both just trying to figure out how to navigate this very strange moment that we knew that we didn't have the basis, right, for a close relationship. And yet there was a deep closeness, I think, in being there as he died. And then I was, and a lot of it was very odd because, like I said, I was a brand new, I keep using the word odd, to vary my vocabulary, but I was someone who was very new to the family. And even though it was sort of very quick that my, and I wound up marrying him, so my boyfriend at the time, but
Rita, I married him.
Yes. Many years later, I wound up marrying him, but it was a very, you know, off the bat, we knew it wasn't sort of, we were just dating, like we were quite serious about each other.
And does Ryan have brothers and sisters?
He has an older sister.
He has an older sister.
Yeah.
So how did
And she also had a whirlwind romance. Her,
really?
Yeah, her girlfriend was there, but they had been together a little bit longer. And
wow, so they'd both sort of found the person and gone, this is it, I'm going to settle
in
down.
In a way, it was sort of, you know, it's very sad, but also very lovely that both myself and his sisters, she eventually wound up marrying her, that we both had the chance to meet Eugene, you know, to have some connections, so sort of weird magic that the universe brings you, I think.
But it must have been hard for you to navigate a new relationship, plus a new family members, like, oh, hi, I'm the new girlfriend, and this is who I am, I hope you like me. Oh, and also someone's dying.
Yes, yes. So it was, and like I said, there's no sort of, there's not like an Emily Post handbook.
No, no.
That particular thing. I think in general, culturally, we're not very good with the etiquette of grief. The funny thing, though, was that his family was actually extremely welcoming, his mom and his sister, because I think they worried about Ryan. And sometimes I think in families especially, there isn't a sense of how to talk to men, I think, about their grief. And I think there was a sense that that I would sort of be there and he wouldn't be alone, you know. And so they were very welcoming to me. And I actually think it was harder for Ryan to be welcoming to me because I think there was a part of him that there's always a certain amount of drama at the beginning of a new relationship. And I think there was a part of him that really wanted the space just to grieve his father. But I was also there. So it was odd because I think he wanted me to be there, but he also didn't want me to be there. I was sort of cluttering up his, like, psychic space in a way.
No, I can understand because it's such a huge thing to go through and you sort of are at your most vulnerable, and I don't mean ugly, but I mean like it's raw. It's raw. So like you may cry and have snot all over your face and you don't want to be thinking, God, I hope this person is like doesn't think I'm an idiot.
I look hot right now.
Like you're still trying to present a kind of nice version of yourself at the beginning, aren't you? Like because when my husband, he lost his dad, we'd been going out quite a while, and then his mum after we were married, and by then, you know, like you've seen everything, like it's done, it was fine. So when, you know, someone's on the ball on the floor and just crying, you're like, yeah, we've been, this is fine. But it must have been a pressure on him.
Very much so. And I think he's also the kind of person who would prefer to go through things on his own, you know, that's sort of his personality. So it was very hard on him, and it was very, I think, difficult on our relationship.
Was there any point where you just thought, God, this is a bit much?
You know, like, I actually think, and we, this is sort of a joke that we have, that we probably should have split up. That it probably would have been better if we had split up and if we had sort of gotten together later on. Because I think what wound up happening was he felt, it's really interesting, isn't it? We have this idea that there's a correct way to grieve. And that's actually partly what my novel was about. And he really felt that he didn't have the chance to grieve correctly, and partly because he was like, you know, that day that there was a service for him, a very beautiful service. He was actually very well known in Toronto, and it was massive. There was actually a spillover venue. And I think Ryan really felt I should have done my grieving that day, but I was there. And they, even his mom and his sister, got me to go up on the stage at one point. But I think for Ryan, he felt like, I actually don't want you to be that involved in this. I want my own space. And so for a long time after, I think for several years after, he felt, at first he just kept this inside, but eventually he told me, he was like, I feel like I didn't get to grieve properly that day because you were there. And I think on the one hand, I could be sympathetic to that, you know, and to say, I also think maybe I shouldn't have been so involved, maybe I should have been sitting closer to the back or something like that. But then there was another part of me that felt that he was being quite hard on himself, and that maybe no matter what, it would have been difficult to grieve that day. And how terrible it is that we give ourselves, we're like, this is my chance. You know, this is the grief holiday, this funeral. And this is my chance to grieve. And if I don't do it now,
that's
then,
it.
Yeah. Because as more time passed, it's now, this was the 10-year anniversary of his death. I think Ryan realized, no, you know, like grief is a long process and there's many different, I think, chances. But
I think that Memorial Day and that funeral, I think it's the only day you're allowed to grieve very freely, I think. Maybe this is unfair to say, but especially perhaps as a man, like, if he'd cried and broken down that day, no one would have been like, oh my God, what's wrong with him?
Yeah.
But equally, I think you're right. Like, if you hadn't have been there, something else would have kept made him keep it together.
Perhaps.
He would have been like, oh, my mum and sister are here.
I think so.
I have to be together for them. Yeah. Like, because it's like, you're just looking for a reason to be okay.
Right, yes, to sort of not, because it's such a painful experience, and also holding it at a distance is.
And like my dad's funeral, like, I didn't break down and dissolve in a way that I thought I would. I was kind of together and talking to my friends and I laughed and because it is so public and something about the publicness, I think, means you sort of, you, well, for me anyway, not everyone's the same, but I was like, oh, I just feel like you're all in my bedroom.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to get, I'm not going to sort of like fall into a ball and cry.
And it's also very surreal. I mean, was your dad, was it sudden when he passed?
Yeah, so he was diagnosed in the February and then dead by April.
Oh, wow. Oh,
my goodness. With secondary liver cancer.
Oh, okay.
So it was in the pancreas, which is another
you don't want to get
stinker.
Yeah.
Real bad, guys.
Oh, my goodness.
So yeah, it was very quick. Mm-hmm. So I think also,
it feels like it's not even happening.
Yeah, how you're can in it really shock, be happening? Definitely. Yeah. And especially if someone has been, my dad was similarly, it's going to be fine, we're going to beat this, you know, together we can do this. Yeah. And so I think that funeral, you're sort of like, oh, I wonder where he is. Like,
well, I think
I wonder if he's around the corner. Yeah,
and it really feels like, and I guess this also sort of like inspired the sci-fi elements of my novel, it feels like a schism has opened up.
Yes.
And that person is just somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, and we'll figure it out and we'll, you know, we'll rejoin the timelines and everything will be fine, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel very real.
That's the one thing I did feel with your novel, that it was very tempting because in the novel when this isn't too much of a spoiler, don't worry. You should still read it. But the fact that it was like they'd lost each other.
Yes.
But somewhere they were alive.
Right.
And I found that as someone who, you know, is like in the grief club, I was like, oh, that's so tempting to have that in your heart, that somewhere they are.
Yeah. He's still
there.
They're
okay.
I can find him. Yeah. And I think the very strong sense that Polly has is this kind of magical thinking where she's like, well, he's there and I'm going to go and get him. But the reader, who may be a little bit wiser than she is and who understands time in a different way than she does because we haven't time jumped, might think, well, maybe he's still there, but it's been 17 years.
Who
is the person that he still is? And I was interested in that too, like how time is a place and place is a time, you know?
Yeah.
I think what started to happen with Eugene and partly I think why it became easier for Ryan to come to terms with the fact that I had been there was because he was able to sort of realize that wasn't my only chance to grieve and this is a thing that will always be with me. But also because once our relationship became it was always serious, but I think once it became clear that we were going to be together, you know, for the rest of our lives, then I think we were both glad. I think that I was there and that I had the chance to go through that with him. Like, I do always feel kind of this shadow life, that alternate world, that schism. To me, he is still there in a very sad way because I never really did get the chance to know him. And yet, he's such an enormous part of my life, you know.
Yeah.
The shape of him is always there in his family, you know, in his absence. And then when my daughter was born, I think we felt it intensely. Like, we actually wound up naming her after him.
Oh, wow.
It's sort of funny. We gave her his Chinese name, which is, so he was born in Shanghai, and so Eugene is like an anglicization of his Chinese name that he took on when he moved west. So we gave her his name, but in Chinese culture, it's not done to actually to name children after other older family members because you're messing with the generations. It's not right.
Oh, so I love that.
I know. It's
guys,
funny.
It's a system. Yeah. Don't muck around with it.
I know.
They're not from the 40s.
Right.
Which is against, I mean, English culture is full of
Right. Just name it after everybody. Yeah. It's the opposite. So we gave her, it's the same sound.
Right.
But a different word. So her
is
name
is... Is that like the same kanji? Or is that only in Japanese?
It's the opposite. It's a different character, right. But the same sound.
Oh, okay.
So like hair and hair.
Yeah, yeah.
So her name is Young.
Young.
Yeah, which actually, by chance... means brave, which I just realized now as I was talking to you.
Oh my god, that's amazing! Yes,
yeah, I just realized that connection. That's funny. Never crossed my mind before. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's really interesting. I spoke to an end-of-life doula named Anna Lyons, and she was saying yesterday, actually, she was saying, you know, the person is still there, they're just not there physically. And I found that really interesting because I think because I'm so afraid for my brain not to accept he's dead, that I'm very like, no, he's gone. He's dead.
Oh,
he's dead.
Need to don't, see it that
yeah,
way.
Don't get any hopes up. But when she said it like that, I was like, oh, because she was like, they're still there emotionally, they're still there in memories, they're still there in the songs, the food, like the presence in that there, but just not there physically. And I think that comes back to what you're saying, that he is still very present in your world, and once you have a child and all that that brings
well,
with
because
it.
She's his relation,
and so a part of him,
and I think in ways he was everyone always says he was like a real joker, like he liked to play sort of practical jokes, and she really has that. And she, from very early on, she had that quality. She's this funny little smile, and I almost sort of feel like that's perhaps a little bit of him, or maybe even just, you know, Ryan is like that from him, and so and I think it is it is nice to sort of feel that he's there. At the same time, it's a complicated thing for me to navigate because I never really knew him.
Yeah.
So I have this very strong sense of him, and this always this feeling that he is there. What would our lives be like if he was physically there? But at the same time, I didn't, you know, I never really knew him like in a direct way. And you know, and so I have these thoughts to myself where. The relationship that we have is sort of through this hallowed lens, you know, but I always think, you know, a very common thing with your in-laws is to get annoyed with them.
Yeah.
So I always wonder, like, would I get annoyed with him? Like, what things about him would have annoyed me, you know? And would he have been, what kind of grandparent would he be?
Yeah.
You know, would he be sort of doting? Would he be wacky? You know, like, my mother-in-law is crazy about my daughter and often lets her do dangerous things because she's so crazy about her. Like, she'll be like, well, she wanted to play with this lit stick of incense, so I gave it to her, you know? And I sort of wonder, would he be like that? Or would he have been like, no, don't give her that incense, you know? It's sort of these funny little things that happen. So, yeah, it's this funny thing where I do have this very strong sense of him and yet no sense of him, and trying to sort of reconcile those two to each other.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
Do you think, does Ryan ever said it, it's important to him that you did meet him those three times, even if it was briefly, like that there was that connection?
He doesn't say that, but I think it's clear. And I think also what I have a stronger connection to is the absence of him, because so every year when the anniversary comes, you know, I think it's everybody deals with their grief in a different way, and I think what Ryan often doesn't want to deal with the anniversary, you know, so I think over the years it would often be, and for a while we were living in Texas away from his family, and so I would sort of be like, let's go and do something, you know, let's go for a walk in the park, let's go to a restaurant that he would have liked, or things like that. So it's funny because I feel like I sort of have become a part of that experience. Though something that was quite bad about it early on, and I don't know if you ever had this experience with your own loss, was that I think I sort of tried to micromanage Ryan's grief.
Oh,
Yeah.
I think it's very, very hard when a partner is grieving.
Yeah.
And I have spoken on the show before that, you know, as someone who's like queen of the grief with my own grief,
right.
And then when it happened to my husband, yeah. I found it very difficult,
right.
And I was very surprised because I thought, oh, I'm going to be fine with this,
mm-hmm.
But actually I personally found it very triggering because it was like his deep upset reminded me of my deep upset,
yeah.
But also it's like, as a partner, and I think this isn't maybe not talked about or admitted enough, of like, it's hard to be around someone who's grieving,
because mm-hmm.
they can be so bleak and sad, you know, the yeah. sadness that yeah. is like in their everything, their yeah. pores are leaking sadness, and yeah. there's times as a partner you're like, oh, I just want you to be happy. I just want you to be okay. And like, how can I fix it? How can I
yeah.
make this okay? Yeah. Rather than, and yeah. it took me a really long time to just go, there's nothing I can do.
Right.
I just have to let you get yes. through this. But yeah, yeah, I definitely yeah. at the beginning was like, right, what should we do? How can we do? How can yeah. we get through it?
Yeah.
So yeah, how did you handle Ryan's
Well,
grief?
I think in the first year, I think I was a real a-hole about it. and not in the sense that I was sort of like, I didn't have that feeling of like, oh, you're no fun, cheer up, loser. Yeah. But more the sense that he wasn't doing it right. You
right,
know?
Right, yeah,
that, like,
yeah. Which is really common, I think, when you haven't lost a parent.
Mm-hmm.
My mum spoke to me when she lost both her parents very quickly, and my dad, when he was alive, was like, oh, I think you should do this, and I think, like, because he and he had both his parents,
yeah,
and my mum said to him, like, you don't know what it feels like,
yeah.
but it's
yeah.
easy to think, oh, maybe you should be crying like this now, and
or I mean, and I think, oh, well, there was a certain selfishness to it as well. I think there's an isolation in grief,
yes,
you know, it
yes.
keeps the people around you away from you, and so I wanted him, I can't even really exactly remember, but perhaps I wanted him to be more open, or I wanted, yeah, I don't know. It was really awful, I think, what I did. I don't have many regrets in life, but I think that period is something that I do regret, that I think I really tried to get in there and be like, do it this way, you
yeah.
know?
And
I don't
way?
Know why. And I think it was also that idea of like, oh, I'll fix this. Oh, you know, like, or even sort of not understanding some behavior as grief behavior.
Yes.
So, for example, like yeah. sleeping all the time and staying up all night playing video games, you know, and like a certain amount of social withdrawal and all these things. And again, we hardly knew each other
yeah.
at that stage. Now that I know him, it's absurd to look back and realize how little I knew him.
Yeah.
And the intensity, I think, of what was happening and what we were going through. And I think he did it at periods in that time because I was taking up too much space, you know,
yeah.
tried to shake me loose. And sort of was unable to. And I think that's where that joke comes from. We're like, we really should have split up. You know, like, poor guy. He really needed a lot of space. And I was very poor, I think, at giving it to him in any sort of way. And then I think at the same time that his loss triggered in me kind of a lot of delayed or buried grief that I had.
Yeah, that's often yeah. what it is. When
yeah.
someone's in the first throes
mm-hmm.
of that rawness,
mm-hmm.
if you've got anything in you,
right.
you're like, oh God,
right.
That's how I feel.
Yeah.
But I get on with it and I hide it. Why aren't you hiding it?
The thing is, and I thought it was really interesting that on your show you prefer for it to be about a person, because I think the issue that I had was that a lot of the grief I had wasn't about a person.
Ah, okay, yeah.
So the passing of Eugene, it gave it sort of a figure for
yeah,
my grief
yeah.
to coalesce around, but also it was something that wasn't mine.
Mm.
And so I was saying to you earlier that I have a short story that's coming out in a little while in Granta, which is about a woman who it used to be called, in much earlier versions, it was called Grief Pervert. Because it's about this woman who has her own grief, and she kind of cottons on to, like, this family who are going through a loss because she's trying to find a way to externalize her own grief.
Yeah, yeah.
And she can't really. In the story, she's lost her sister. But for me, what it was my early life was marked by a lot of moving. We moved sort of across the world many different times. And I think by the time I became an adult, I had this really strong sense of loss for ways of life, I think, that were gone. Because when you leave a place, you lose not just that place, but also I think the life you had there,
all
the sort of trappings that came with it. But that's, you know, that's a loss without shape.
Yeah,
it's difficult
yeah.
to talk to. It's talk about. It's difficult to think about. But I think it does get triggered because, and often the way, especially if you do a lot of this moving, the way of managing is to not manage it. You know, it's just be like, well, you know, like carry on.
That's gone. Oh well.
Yeah. And what on to the next thing. And especially, I think, when you're young, you sort of have the sense of yourself as being very resilient. And I was, like, a teenager.
And so his grieving kind of brought it up for you.
Yeah, it did. It did. And a lot of other things that, like I said, my uncle had passed away. My friend had passed away. And all of these losses, because of the nature of my life, you know, going back and forth and being all over the place, happened very far away.
Mm.
So there's something very different, I think, about someone losing someone who's a part of their daily life.
Yeah.
About that constant reminder. And it was almost, like I was like greedy of that grief, you know, of that understanding of being able to inhabit grief in that way. Because not only had I lost people who weren't in my daily life, so I could never really make sense of the loss. Like I always think, my uncle, he's still there. I just haven't seen him in a few years, you know. Or those places, like that, like I said, like that's like a grief that has no shape. All those places that I'd lost. So that it was, I never had any proper way to kind of think about it or navigate it or a process through which. So yeah, there was a way, I think, that I was trying to be like, here's my chance.
It's my chance to get it out.
Weird way, yeah.
But also, do you think there was your thought of like, well, I don't have a shape to my grief and I just kind of get on with it. And then here is this man who has a shape and is just in it. Like, was
I wonder. That wasn't a conscious thought, but that could have been.
Of like, oh, I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could just sleep and play video games and feel it in that way. Yeah.
So there, I think there was almost something for me, and it's like yucky to say, but there was almost something for me that was therapeutic about being grief adjacent.
You know?
It was like, like we were saying earlier, it's as if there's this idea of when it's appropriate to grieve.
Yeah.
And for me, all those times had long passed, you know. My uncle had been gone several years. My friend was a friend who, she was far away, so a lot of people in my life didn't even know I had lost somebody, you know. And then all those places, it would had been nearly 10 years since I'd stopped moving. And so suddenly, here was this sort of idea of, here was a pause that he was in, and I could be in that pause with him and maybe go through that. But you can't have somebody taking up your grief space. You know.
Well, it's hard not to, I think, because often, like, when my husband was right in the throes of losing his mom, you know, the way he spoke, I couldn't help but be like, yeah, that's how I feel about my dad. And, you know, when we would talk about them, and then you'd be like, both be sad. Mm-hmm. And you're like, it's hard not to empathize, because I think that's what we do as humans. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, yeah, I do know how that feels. So this is how I feel when this happens. And that's how you connect with each other. And I suppose it's interesting because they become almost, which is, I think, relates to your book, they become kind of these sort of magical people.
Yeah.
They're in this moment that they have no control over, whereas the rest of the world and you, one, at that time is like getting on with it and powering through.
Yeah.
And but they're so overwhelmed,
right,
especially just after someone's died.
Yes, yeah.
And they become not part of the human world, which is why they feel so isolated, because they, you know, they are. They are on the other side of a river going, I don't know how you all act like we're all going to die. Like, why are you all just carrying on like this doesn't happen?
And you, and I think you, when you have experienced loss and you work so hard, I think, every day to be like, it's fine.
It's fine.
You know,
everyone
dies, but it's fine.
Yeah.
To see someone who's sort of torn away the veil and they're in that space, you sort of want to be there with them because you're like, it's not fine.
Yeah.
It's not fine. And you want to go back to that place.
Yeah. And it's a very harsh realization, I think, because you do think, oh, God, it's not okay when someone dies. It is abhorrently painful.
No.
And there they are, literally living it. Like I said, it just leaks out of them. It's like everything about their energy and their being is this just, I'm so sad. How does this, why did this happen? And you're like, oh God, that's life and I don't have any answers.
Yeah. Like, and I think at the same time as you want to go there, because you're like, oh, that feels like a truer reality.
Yeah.
I want to spend time with them in that place. At the same time, because you've gone through it, you feel, well, I want to cure it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's where that idea comes from. You, of course, you want to be empathetic. And I think I would say things to him. He would tell me, I'd be like, oh, yes, I know exactly what that's like.
Mm.
And I would try to sort of repeat back to him maybe things that I would have wanted people to have said to me if I'd been able to be open to my grief. And then if those things didn't magically make him be like, oh, I feel better now. I'd be like, why didn't it work?
Yeah.
You know? And some people have kind of fixer personalities, I think, to a certain extent, with especially people who I'm very close to. I have that personality, you know?
Yeah, I definitely do as well. I'm a real fixer. And I would say it took me probably 6 months to a year to stop trying to fix him. I think.
And did that cause you conflict?
Yeah, it definitely did. It definitely did. And then, there was, you know, huge rows. And when they're grieving as well, and it was so interesting to be on the other side, having been the griever for so long.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, and I think this is worth remembering if you are grieving and people seem like they're being rubbish. It's like, you're such a mess when you're grieving. You're so angry and sad. Like, you're so full of emotions that it is really hard to have conversations with them, and it is really hard to rationalise, and everything comes back to the grief. So it can be quite like, oh, I was just making a comment about the washing up. I wasn't saying, you know, that it's fair that your mum died. but everything gets turned into that.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of rows, and then I think it just took me a long time. I can't remember what clicked, but I think I just got fed up and was like, because I'm a fixer, and I was like, well, this isn't working, so I need to fix myself.
Yeah.
So I was like, what am I doing wrong? I finally accepted it wasn't his fault. And I just thought, oh, I just need to just accept it. And the funny thing happened with us, I think, that actually after I stopped, he got quite frustrated because he was like, why aren't you trying to help anymore? And I was like,
oh my.
Yeah, and then I had to sort of, it was quite a big turning point because I had to be like, I can't.
Yeah.
And he was sort of like, what do you, but that's, I've been hoping you would fix me. I've been telling you it's all wrong,
right?
But I've been sort of hoping you're gonna get there. And when I was like, I'm never gonna get there, like, you have to do it. And then he was like, oh god. I have to do it. And I was like, yeah, you have to pull yourself through this. I can't do it. And that's not to say there's a pressure or a time limit on it, but I think that realization, which is hard with a partner because, you know, you love them so much and you, so many things you go through together, to understand, like you said, that grief space is entirely theirs, and you cannot go through it. You actually really can't go through it with them. You can be there, you can wave from the other side of the river and be like, keep going, I think you're doing great, but you actually can't make them swim across it.
Yeah, and I think what I had to do was to separate my grief from his.
Yes,
and
yes.
to start to understand, because I had poor self-awareness of why I was doing what I was doing, you know. And it's funny because at the same time as I wanted to be in that grief space with him, it was also a way of staying away from my own grief.
Yes,
it was like simultaneously two things, you know, like to sort of get all that good grief juice, but then also to be like, this is about you, it's not about me. And I think for me, I was able to get out of his space and a little bit more, I think, give him that space that he needed, when I was able to be like, I'm upset, you know, about all these things. And these are things that I need to actually accept, that that I carry these things with me, that I haven't metabolized them, and that I don't feel okay about them. And I have to start to think about that on my own, you know,
and let
him do what he's doing and go and do what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think that's a very good advice for relationships, that you can't fix them. You can just go, oh, what is this reminding me of?
Right.
It's reminding me of me.
Yeah.
So why don't
Something's
I
happening.
You can fix yourself.
I have
you
to
can
go do that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think I went to therapy not that long after that, actually. I think, and it was funny because I was really like, you need counseling, you need like to him. And then I was like, oh god, I need counseling. Like,
I know.
That's,
I know,
what
and it
is.
Was funny because I think that was one of the ways that I did try to micromanage Ryan's group, to be like, you should go talk to somebody. And then he did, and it wasn't any good, you know. Sometimes you it's not a good fit for
it.
He saw actually several therapists, went after the other, who made him feel worse. You know, but I think the most wonderful thing you can realize about grief, this is a horrible thing to realize, but maybe a wonderful thing, but that it's forever.
Stop fighting it. I definitely had that. I was like, well, when is this over? And the fight is like, well, when am I going to feel better? And it's like, you will, but it's never going to go away. And I think as a griever, you think, well, eventually I'll hit the right time, or I'll do the right thing, and it'll just go. It's like, they'll always be your dad. That's, you know, that they don't stop being your dad or stop being your parent. So of course the grief doesn't just go, you just learn to live with it. You learn to manage it, and you know, talk to someone or not talk to someone or figure out how you feel about it. But yeah, it is forever, definitely.
Yeah, and you don't have to have that sense like, I've got to sort this out now, because you have the rest of your life, I think, which is awful, because I think you want to think like, oh, like it'll be gone.
Yeah.
But it's also, I think it's a comfort in a way, and you realize that this is just always with me now, you know, in the way that like you said, that I think Eugene is still always with us, for me in these sort of funny ways, and for his family members in these very true ways, you know, he never goes away.
So when did you start writing the book? Was it soon after he died?
So it was... I had the idea, like I became really obsessed, I think, with bereavement. I became really fascinated by it. And it's funny because I keep saying this in interviews, and maybe Canadian journalists are just very polite, but nobody ever asked me why. So I'm glad that I got away with it. I'm always like, yeah, I was really interested in grief, and no one's ever like, why?
Why, yeah, apart from this show.
Yeah, I know.
So what happened?
I know, I'm putting my cards on the table, finally letting it out.
Yeah.
But so I became really fixated specifically on that idea that that everybody has experienced some awful loss, and yet we all behave as if we haven't, you know? And all the time, I think, you always have friends who are sort of in a bitter frame of mind, and they're like, everyone's having a great life and I'm having an awful life. But the truth is that everyone has something horrible that they're carrying, that they just, you know, they just keep getting on the bus and they just keep feeding their cat, you know? And I was really fixated and fascinated, and both sort of fascinated and horrified by that. Like, how do we just keep acting as if everything is fine? And also, I was interested in the place of love within all of that. Like, we keep acting like everything's fine. Not only do we keep feeding our cats, we keep falling in love, even though we know it's such a dangerous thing to do, you know?
That's interesting.
Like, we understand, when you understand the depths of loss, you know what you might be getting yourself into if you become attached to someone, and yet we keep doing it. So that was what I really started to think about. And I took several runs at it, and so it's kind of funny, the short story that I mentioned that's coming out in Grant is actually something I wrote before the novel.
Ah, wow.
Yeah, so it's been hanging around for a long time, and it was something that I kept tinkering with. And it has very similar themes, though expressed in a more sort of acerbic way. than in my novel. And so eventually, I think it was, I guess it was about, it would have been about 3 years after he passed away that I started writing the novel, which was very much, I think, not so much necessarily about his death, but about everything.
Yeah.
Like what his death brought up, I think, in me, which was this sense that you never stop wanting to be the same, to be more in more than one place and more than one person at once. You know, you always are sort of chasing these former lives that have been lost to you. And even if we had time travel, we still would never be able to shake that feeling, you know, that eternal sense of loss.
Yeah, it doesn't solve, there is no magic solution.
No.
And I think it's really interesting in the book, there is this option to go anywhere,
yes,
you know, and yet there's still all these problems.
just as now, right? I mean, I think like 1,000 years ago, if people had airline travel, they'd be like, well, then all our problems would be solved.
But no,
you know, there's still these enormous, I think, fissures in everyday life.
I think it's interesting you talk about the grief of places, because that's very prevalent in the book, that, you know, she goes back to the town that she's from 17 years on, and it's completely different. And I think we could
gone.
It's gone. And we can all relate to that feeling where people keep saying, I like the bit in the book, people kept saying, it's here. Look out the window, it's here.
It's
and
there.
She's like, it's not there. It's Buffalo, isn't it? She's like, it's not Buffalo. It's not.
It's something else. And that actually comes from my experiences of growing up in Singapore, which is a place that changes at breakneck speed. So I would be gone a few years, and I would come back and take the subway somewhere, and I would get off and I'd go up to the street level, and I think, did I get off at the wrong stop? I'd have to recheck the signs because I couldn't recognize the neighborhood at all. So
it's a really interesting concept when you relate that to people, of like, they're gone. That is it.
Yeah.
Like you said, it doesn't mean they're not with you in the other ways, but physically and literally they are, that person, that place is gone, and here we are searching for it.
I know, and I wonder, when a place is gone, it seems like it is gone, not in the way that when people are gone, they're still there. Like, I feel like those places that are gone, they're really gone, especially if they were, for me, so for example, the Singapore of the 90s that I grew up in, I feel like that place is really gone. Mm. Because it also is a personal thing. It's a place that existed within your mind.
Yeah.
You know? And Kazuo Ishiguro actually has a really beautiful thing that he wrote about that in his, when he won the Nobel Prize, he gave a lecture and he talks at length about the reason why he wrote his first novel is because he was born in Japan and he left when he was five. He found himself sort of very furiously writing about Japan, which he'd never really done up until the point when he started that novel. And he realized that what he was trying to do was to put his Japan, as he called it, right, this idea that he had of this place down on paper. And that at least then he could say, well, it's there. You know, like I've put it somewhere and I've captured it, you know, and it'll be safe there.
But I think that's really true of people. Mm-hmm. As someone who's lost my dad, mm-hmm. I think I spend my life trying to capture my dad.
Mm-hmm. So my he'll be somewhere. He'll exist somewhere.
And like this podcast, you know, I talk to different people every week, but I'm always talking about my dad.
Yeah.
And that's not my brother's dad. That's not my mum's husband. Oh, it's, you know what I mean? It's like, that's my version of him that I am trying to capture.
Right.
Because he's gone.
Yeah.
He is gone.
Yeah.
And, you know.
It's really interesting because I always think that when you're in a family, you have a shared experience of someone and that's almost what keeps them afloat. And I guess that's what I was saying about the places that I feel like my Singapore only belonged to me.
Yeah.
And so it can't have presence anywhere else in the world. But I guess you're right that we do have these very particular relationships to the people that we loved. And even if your brother also had him as a dad, it's not the same thing.
It's not. And you have a shared experience. And I can say to my brother, oh, do you remember when he did this? And we can both laugh.
Yeah. But you might even have different memories of him doing that.
Everyone has different memories. Mm-hmm. And we can't, oh my God, ask if you have siblings. The easiest way to start an argument is like, do you remember? Because they're like, that's not what
that's
happened.
That's funny. My sister and I have a joke that I cover the first 10 years. Sorry. My sister covers the first 10 years, remembers that, and I remember all the rest.
Right.
So we've divided.
Yeah.
So if I ever think that something happened in the first 10 years, and my sister's like, no, that's not what happened. It's just because I'm like, well, I'll defer to you. That's
exactly. She could be wrong. Yeah. It's just her memory of it. And like, you know, if you think about parents, like, they have very different relationships with all their children.
Yeah.
There will be similarities, of course, but they're only your parent to you in the way that they are because that's, you know, the nature of relationships.
Right.
It's those two people.
Yeah.
And when you're alone, that's not the same as when the other people are alone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like my version of my dad is, very different to my brother's and obviously my mum's experience as him as a husband. And, I think I really understand what you're saying about Singapore, because that's how I feel about my dad, of like trying to, I think that's a creative person's answer to it, of like, if I can nail it down, if I can write them down, then they're there, at least they're there.
Yeah.
Like at least maybe you have this like Singapore's there on that paper.
Right.
And somehow it's real and it did happen.
Yeah.
So I think otherwise you feel a bit crazy.
Yeah, I know, but it's funny because I'd love to meet Kazuo and ask him
whether or not
he really did then feel, okay, this place is safe. Because even though the writing of my whole novel was animated by this sense of, like, how do we love when we know that everything ends, I don't think that the writing of the novel answered any of those questions.
Yeah, well,
and I
think
I sort of joke that, you know, writers don't write about the things they have the answers to. They write about the things they don't understand to sort of, like, outsource the problem onto other people. But
I don't think I've answered it.
No,
and it hasn't cured me. But it's like what drives you, I suppose. Because I'm still doing this podcast and I'm still talking about him. It's not like I've gone, oh, there he is.
Yeah, sorted.
Yeah, because you're always changing. So your relationship to the memory always changes.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing with grief. Like you said, you know, you've just had the 10-year anniversary. Like, the way that grief changes in 10 years is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And also not. Like, also you can completely remember that sadness, but you've changed the person or you've become a parent and all of those things.
One thing, so my friend who died, I guess we both were 25 when she died, and it was really awful. She was in Chile, and there was a fire in a hostel, and she died.
Oh, my goodness,
yeah.
That's awful.
Yeah. I mean, so she always would sleep on her passport, and her passport was intact, and so what they said that meant was that she must have just died in her sleep. So that was sort of, I think, a comfort to her family. But I think at the time when she died, we all said, she loved to travel, and so we all said, she died doing something that she loved, and we talked a lot about all the things, she had a very short life, but she'd done so many things, and how many people she touched, and then when I started to think about her death, so last year was the 10-year anniversary of her death, in terms of grief changing, it was like I suddenly had this space to not need to make it sound all right, you know?
Yeah.
And now I feel like it was awful. There's nothing good about it, you know, especially I think now being a little bit older and thinking she probably would have wanted to have gotten married. She probably would have wanted to have a family. She had just started her teaching career and she loved teaching, you know, what would she have done? And now I just feel like there's nothing good about her death. Of course, she had a good life and she was a wonderful person and I'm glad I knew her. But it's a tragedy and nothing... Yeah.
And that's
nothing
okay.
takes that away.
That's
yeah, but okay. I don't think I could have had that thought at the time that it was so bleak and it was such the finality and the horror of the loss. I just couldn't have thought about it that way. I needed to think about it as like, oh, well, you know, she was doing what she loved. You know?
And it's so common. And, you know, when my dad died, everyone was full of, he would have hated to be ill for so long. It's good it was quick.
Right.
It would have really upset him. You know, he would have hated it. Hated it. And we were all like, yes. And then again, years later, I was like, well, I actually don't think he would have minded because we would have been around and we would have had
longer.
More time.
Yeah.
But it's that when something is so awful, you have to, that power of language, you know, you twist the narrative and you say, no, it was a good ending.
Yeah.
Look, everyone, it's happy. Yeah.
And then it's the story you need.
Yeah. It's the story your brain needs to carry on getting up and feeding the cat.
And then I think over time, your brain toughens up or something like that and you're able more to I think live in the reality of what really happened.
So did she die the same year as your father-in-law?
Almost exactly a year apart.
She was the year before.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yes. Interesting, isn't it? That I talk about him but not about her.
That is really interesting that grief was obviously so, and it is difficult when someone young dies and that isn't an easy narrative.
And it was very difficult to think about her. She was from Vancouver. We had actually met, very funny, in England. And then we'd both been living in the same province, the province of Ontario, when we were undergrads, and so we'd see each other often. But the service was in Vancouver because that's where her family was. And I didn't wind up going to the service, which I always sort of regret that would have helped me to make more sense of it. And the funny thing is that I've kept in touch with her parents and one of her best friends, who I never met before she died, but we keep in touch and... you know, they send me Christmas cards and stuff like that. And for a long time, I thought I kept in touch with them because it was a nice thing to do. Mm. You know, I was like, oh, you know, like I feel badly for their loss. But now, I don't know, it's so funny. The things you tell yourself, it's so weird. Now I'm like, obviously, I kept in touch with them because I needed to keep, because it was something for me too. Yeah. I wasn't just being like such a nice young person, you know. Like, and I think it was easy. Another thing I told myself was, because we had been quite young and we were friends, and I have a lot of friends from that time who I don't keep in very close touch with.
Yeah.
So I think I sort of, well, you know, she would have been a friend of my youth. We would have lost touch anyways.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Who knows?
You know? Yeah. So, yeah, it was something that was impossible to make sense of because it didn't make sense, you know? And also, like I said, not having her as part of my everyday life, never having gone to the service. But again, you know, it's something that... It's sort of always above you. It's like always in your atmosphere. It never leaves you.
And I think we've talked about in the show, when grief with friends, it can be very difficult to feel like you're allowed to be upset because they're a friend and you're removed from that family.
Yeah.
So I guess when Ryan lost his dad, it's like, oh,
this grief is
legitimate.
Yeah, I can go here.
My grief is, well, it's fine. Yeah. It happened. These things happen.
No. The same thing with, there was a lot actually of my uncle who had passed away. And I guess he had passed away almost exactly a year before her.
Wow.
And it was very awful. I mean, he had a terrible drinking problem. And I think I'm actually still not even entirely sure how he died. It was either because I think it was just complications to do with having drunk so much. But he was at home in his own home. And I'm pretty sure he died alone. That's impossible to make sense of, really, just for someone to die in such an awful way. He was very young, and he was my mother's favorite brother, you know. And so I think also feeling, and that's not something that she really talks about.
Mm.
And I think I definitely have sort of an intense relationship with my mother, and that was almost too much.
Yeah,
like, sort of to understand that she had gone through such an unthinkable loss, you know. And it's just almost like our entire family is just like, well, let's just not think about that one.
Yeah.
You know, like it's just... It's just too much. So as awful it was when Eugene died, and he was quite young, he was 60, at the same time, it was a better death than all those other deaths, which is not a very nice thing to talk about, but I do feel there are better deaths.
Oh my goodness,
there are better ways to go.
Yeah, and to be around a family that love you.
Yes, and all of his family members, they lived in different places, but they all came to see him, and so he got to say goodbye to everyone. So it was almost like the safe death, you know, or the safe kind of loss that I could start to piece together, you know, and that could help me to make sense of the other losses I'd had, which were horrifying in their own ways. But then again, it wasn't my loss, you know.
So but I think it's totally understandable. Yeah. It sounds to me like you had these two very confusing and traumatic and, you know, really, really sad deaths that I think even when you have like, a sort of more normal death of like, oh, my dad died of cancer, it's like, it's so overwhelming. And I went into shock, I would say, for 20 years, you know, because I was 15. I think I just went, I just can't deal with this. So I'm going to put it over here and I'm going to carry on because I just cannot get my head around what the fuck just happened. So, of course, when your partner is going through that, it's like, oh, I can, these tears are coming from somewhere. And maybe it is my grief. And but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's how we help each other. And funnily enough, like you married him because somehow you were able to recognise the place he was in. And I think that can be quite important for people who are grieving. If your partner has had no experience of it at all, well, I mean, who has no experience of it? But if your partner is like, no, I'm fine. My grandparents said I'm fine. Like, it can be really important to recognise the state they're in and then have to recognise the state that perhaps, like you said, that you're in. Because to have that death, like, just the year before and then walk into that, that must have been... Yeah, I'm sure at the time you were like, this is completely different, but of course it's going to influence that.
I think it was all there. It's funny, too, you saying that it must have been okay because we got married, because we used to sort of say, like, we got married in spite of how terrible the beginning of our relationship is. But I think something we haven't revisited recently at all is how did it maybe actually help us? Because at the time it did really feel like an awful kind of toxic relationship because we became so codependent, and it was, we had to sort of break those habits in order to in the end have, like, I think, a nice relationship. But I do have to wonder, like, how did it bring us together in a way? Like, if we hadn't gone through that awful experience and had that really rotten relationship with each other for a few years, would we have gotten married? I don't know.
Well, also you kind of did it backwards.
We did.
I think most people, like, they have the nice bit and then something happens and you're really, you see the true colours of that person. But you kind of, like, saw them straight away. This is him at his worst.
With no context. With no context to make any sense of it.
There he is. Completely vulnerable. And here am I, dealing with my own grief, completely vulnerable. And I think, if you can get through that, you're fine.
Maybe.
So Daya, Ocean of Minutes is available to buy now, I'm guessing, from all good bookshops.
Everywhere,
it's an amazing book, and
thank you so much.
Is very, I found some passages really tough, just because I think you write about grief and some and loss very well. So there were some bits I was like, oh God. But
sorry about that.
No, but in a good way, because I think, in a good way, in a resolving way, in a way that narrative helps. So I highly, highly recommend it.
Thank you so much
for coming to talk to me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure.
You can follow Teya on Twitter at Teya_Lim. That's TEA_LIM. And her book, An Ocean of Minutes, is available to buy in paperback now. You can follow us on Twitter at The Griefcast and on Instagram at The Griefcast, and you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, please do rate and review and subscribe. It helps other people find us. The show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios, and the music is provided by The Glue Ensemble. I'm very tired. I'm sorry. I know I say it every week, but I've managed to muck it up about 5 times. What I won't forget to say is, remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.